This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I have a very special guest today for a special report about the Bilderberger meeting that has recently taken place in Copenhagen with Ole Damgaard. Ole, tell us more. You were there, of course, on the scene and noticed very unusual circumstances that led you to suspect that a false flag attack might be in the making. Can you fill us in?
I sure can. For the listeners who might not know about me, I spent about 30 years looking into major assassinations, terror acts, false flag operations, and so on. One of the things that I, like so many other researchers, have found out that the so-called Bilderberg Group is very central in the power elite that are behind more or less all of these terror acts. So that is why I've spent many years trying to reveal the members, the agenda, and where they meet, so that we can, by exposing them, then make it a lot more difficult for them to push their agenda through like a hidden secret world government almost in the background without anyone knowing why. And so this year I was invited to Copenhagen. That's actually the city where I was born many years ago. So I flew in from Spain. And normally when they arrange these Bilderberg meetings, they are not always, but many times it's in a secluded five-star super luxury hotel, easy to control security-wise, easy to secure all parameters. And days ahead, there are police, military sometimes, surveillance, bomb-sniffing dogs, these type of things. But done in a very secretive way so that normal people will not even know that the meeting is there or who is there and so on. So when I arrived to Copenhagen, I asked, could you please drive me straight to the hotel? This was the evening before the whole meeting was about to begin. So less than 12 hours before the members were supposed to arrive. So I was expecting, you know, security measures, you know, the whole shebang with the helicopters, police, all of that. I arrived to the hotel, absolute zero. There was absolutely nothing. There were two police officers, Danish police officers, on site. That was the whole thing, nothing else. And they had, when I arrived, it was just like a few, maybe half an hour after they started building like a concrete wall or fence around this five-star hotel. So I got very confused and surprised, and I started looking around. It was only, we were very few people there. There were a few people from InfoWars, myself, and these two police officers. That was it. And the thing that that struck me with this hotel as soon as I heard about it was that it's so badly chosen from a security point of view, because it's in central Copenhagen, right by one of the main streets. You got only like 500 meters to the city train station. You got on one side of the hotel, it's an open water canal, like at least 500 meters wide. So, and then on the other side, a big part of Copenhagen, meaning that if they were fearing sort of like an attack with a missile or a stinger, you know, a bazooka, whatever, these type of thing, the hotel would be so open and vulnerable. And the whole building is made of glass, so you can look in through from the front and the back and see, you know, the stairs and the corridors and so on. So it did not make sense at all.
Did this turn out to be the hotel at which the meeting was actually held, or a decoy?
Good question, Jim. I still don't know. But what they had done, they had placed like three of these black limos right outside the entrance. There was no people, just these three polished, identical limos. And these are the type of vehicles they normally arrive in, you know, tinted windows, black, and so on. So I got a very eerie feeling, because I thought, these people, I mean, they're not stupid, you know, and they got very high skilled security advisors, military advisors, and so on. So why on earth would they choose a hotel like this? Did not make any sense. So just like you, I thought option one, decoy, You know, they're trying to get the whole truth movement gathered here, and then they will meet in a different location, you know, maybe a castle, a military base, or a five-star hotel somewhere else. But, like, it did not make sense at all. And so I started looking around from one of the people of it. Not stupid in any way. So I thought, why did they pick this hotel? I looked around, and like I say, the hotel is built right on the, what do you call it, like the beach of this canal, like on the edge of it, and right in front of them, one of the main streets. Then on the other side of this main street, there's a big open area that is normally used as a big parking lot for the Danish police. It's a graveled area, and then on the other side of that, that is where they fenced in, where the whole truth movement was supposed to be, you know, controlled by police, let in by police, but totally fenced in. And then right on the other side of that were the police headquarters of Copenhagen, a massive big building. On the sides, there were, on both sides of this area, were insurance companies and banks owned and controlled by members of the elite. So I thought, you know, if we look at this from a different point of view, this could be the perfect spot for something totally different. And with my years in false flag operations, you know, finding out what was going on, how they set them, the whole thing up, what methods they used and so on, suddenly it just hit me, oh my God, it is the perfect spot for a false flag operation. A massacre where they can in one go just knock out the whole truth movement globally and then use that as a way to demonize the truth movement, to enforce censorship on the internet and, you know, ban all rights of protests, of demonstrations, of gathering in big groups and so on. Because when you look at it, if you could get, I mean, I walked up and down and just checked it out and saw that, I mean, this is the way it could be done. You know, you get the whole truth movement in front of the hotel, like preferably for them, a couple of thousand people in there. On the other side of the street, you got the hotel, you get some doubles in there, but in general, the whole hotel would be totally empty. You place a lot of explosives inside the hotel, some smoke bombs in the area where the truth movement is gathered. Then you get aerial photos with helicopters, and you get a team down the street, a film crew with a wide angle that will cover both the truth movement and the hotel. And then from also you have a possibility to cover footage coverage from all the different buildings as well surrounding the whole place, because these buildings are totally in their control. So the way they could have pulled it off, I'm not saying that this is what was the plan, but I tell you there was a lot of things aiming in that direction. So what they would have done would to get as many as people in there in the fenced-in area controlled by the police who would not be aware of that this was a possible false flag. Then if the crowd wasn't really agitated before, what you would do would just send in a handful of provocateurs. You know, you only need like four or five of these type of people, start throwing rocks, start screaming, maybe a Molotov cocktails, one of these things, to get the crowd going. And then if that wasn't enough, then you could just arrest somebody right in front of the whole crowd on the other side of the fence, you know, towards the street. People in uniforms that would be part of the provocateur team, but they would look like Danish police officer. They would arrest someone that would also be part of the provocateurs, and then drag this guy screaming and shouting down the street right in front of the whole crowd, making them go absolutely crazy, you know, like, let him go, these type of things. At the same time, throw in a Molotov or two to stir the whole thing to get it going. And then once that's going, then suddenly, boom, you blow out the whole front of the hotel, and the explosion would only I mean, the debris and so on would only come on top of the truth movement. The buildings on the sides were far away enough so that they wouldn't be damaged. And I would say if this was the setup, then I would very much like someone to check out the insurance policy for this hotel, because if you follow the template, at least a week ahead, they would have changed the policy so that it would include terror acts. And also sometimes when they blow these buildings up, it's because they need repair or very, you know, maybe there's a problem with the foundation because it's close to the water, or asbestos or something like that, that it would be a big hill for one of them. So they just blow the whole thing up, blame it on someone else, and then collect billions on the insurance. So what would happen then after the explosion, then they would pump out straight away in the media that, oh my God, this truth movement, I mean, here they are saying they're peaceful and looking for a better world, and what do? They blow up this poor, innocent little group of elite people that were just meeting to have a cup of tea and massacre them. So this awful truth movement, we need to stop them. And we need to control their way of spreading information, because it's leading to these type of terror acts. So we need to censor the internet. We need to ban all rights to demonstrate and to protest and so on. That was the setup I saw. So what I did was I went straight to a friend of mine who had internet access and contacted you. I also contacted Chip Tatum, who's he's a CIA whistleblower, a former deep cover agent for 25 years for the CIA, black op assassin, and who was also part of Pegasus, a super secret team of assassins personally controlled by George Bush Sr. He has also been part of these false flag operations, so we're not talking about an amateur in any way. I phoned him, I described the whole setup. He said, so what about the protection from behind the hotel? Were there any military vessels, divers in the water? I said, absolute zero. He said, get out. There's something very wrong here, you know. And he said, be aware of strange sounds. Be aware of, I think he said, you know, if there's strange packages or explosives that could be hidden, like in parking meters and these type of things. In that case, just get away, you know. So I said, absolutely not. I'm going to be there, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to try everything I can to expose it beforehand, so to diffuse the whole thing. So I spent half the night contacting radio stations like you, getting people to record the time and date of when this information came out, not to polish my own glory saying, you know, I was the one who knew beforehand, but to stop them, you know, to put the spotlight right on them, saying that if you pull that trigger, if you do that, we know what you're up to. We knew before you even did it. So anyway, I spent half the night doing that. And then in the morning, believe it or not, Jim, in the morning when I came to the area, I was one of the first who came there. Somebody had placed a 6-meter big pentagram in the middle of the area where the truth movement was supposed to meet. You know, a pentagram of all symbols. Can you imagine an aerial photo of this blown up building with smoke and dead bodies and all of this, and in the middle of the truth movement, a big pentagram? Can you imagine the impact of an image like that going out in media?
Oli, what you're describing is such a plausible scenario. I would not be at all surprised that you were exactly right and that you blew their cover. I mean, taking out an old building, of course, was tried and true on 9/11 with the Twin Towers, which were loaded with asbestos, which had problems with tenancy, where the transfer to Larry Silverstein just 6 weeks ahead of 9/11 led to his firing the security firm that had looked after the building since it first opened in 1970, and of course obtaining a new insurance policy with an anti-terrorist clause, so that he, claiming there had been two hits by planes, got double indemnity over $4.5 billion on a $114 million investment. So I think we have a model for precisely what you're describing here, and I must commend you for sizing it up so well.
Thank you, Jim, and thank you for being so fast to give me good advice and also to get this information out there beforehand. I was just so focused on trying to stop this. So I'm so grateful that if this was the plan, that they didn't manage to pull it off.
Well, your heart must have been in your throat while you were there on the scene, Ole, given the potential hazard that this represented. I think it's extremely commendable that you took the actions you did to alert the public, because once the word is out, then it assumes an entirely different character and becomes incriminating of the perps rather than devastating to the protesters.
Yeah, I totally agree, and thank you for your warm words. It was like I was just so focused on blowing the whole thing apart for them, you know, not literally, but just defusing the whole situation.
Were you ultimately able to track the actual meeting itself and determine where, in fact, it actually took place? You suggested possibly in a castle, another five-star hotel, what have you.
There were rumors saying that they met in a castle just outside Copenhagen called Kokkedal, but I have no idea. What I did notice, though, was that morning when they're supposed to write, I mean, we're talking about 140 members of this group from international, many, many different countries, and normally they arrive like one or two people in each cars, you know, with bodyguards, sometimes with bodyguards following the car, the vehicles and so on. So there should have been a long line of vehicles coming in. I only saw a handful. I mean, I was giving interviews nonstop when I was there, but so I wasn't that focused, but I did not see this whole long line of vehicles. That is the standard thing. But then it was almost like during the first day, there was very little protection or you know, military cover, anything like that. It was only the police was controlling us, not that they. It seemed like they were afraid of anything else. But then on the second day, I believe if what I think was right, that this was set up as a false flag, they would have stayed away a long distance away from this whole thing. And then when this was blown, the cover was blown, they needed to get back into the building to get alibi, saying, no, but we were there the whole day. You know, why would we have done a thing like that? So suddenly on the second day, you had all these vehicles coming. People started seeing. I heard people had seen Queen Sophia from Spain, Queen Beatrix. Somebody said they saw Henry Kissinger. I did not see a single soul that I recognized. I saw quite a lot of them with, you know, they had these tags around the neck and walking around inside the hotel. Some of them waving on the inside. I did not recognize any of them. And I think if this was a planned false flag massacre, what they would have done was to blow up a handful of people inside the hotel, you know. But these people would be like security people, staff from the kitchen or cleaning staff, maybe some bodyguards, and then maybe pop in a few old Bilderbergers that they had problems with anyway, just to give it credibility. But this is the scenario I believe was set up.
Fascinating, Ole, absolutely fascinating. I gotta say, I'm just in awe of your ability to size up the situation, which seems to me to be completely reasonable, a very rational analysis, and under conditions of considerable stress, especially when you realize that you may be among those who are going to be targeted by the event that appears to be in the planning.
I know, but what to do.
The Pentagon is such a nice touch.
Yeah, exactly. No, but what happened on the second day was that suddenly these cars started arriving, as far as I could see, and suddenly you had this type of surveillance you would have expected. You know, there were a lot more police. There were, NATO soldiers behind the building in military vessels. There were people said they saw snipers. I did not see anyone. But that whole thing then, that it was the way that it was supposed to be. So I think if they were there at all, that would be on, I think, the second day. But I think the chance of them having met somewhere totally different is quite big. I must say also that I have to share this because it was one of the most beautiful things in my life. I gave a speech just outside the Marriott Hotel. Actually, I gave two during the day. And the first day, I just focused on, you know, I'm not here to spread fear or anger or hatred in any kind of way. I'm here to totally, fearlessly try and, you know, expose them. And that we together, if we stand very brave and strong and courageous, together we can stop this whole mad thing, you know. And while I was doing that, I saw there was one guy that got a bit pale and pulled away from, he was standing quite close to me, he pulled away, and later he came up and he said that he saw somebody that looked like a sniper on the roof that aimed something at me. He didn't want to be in the line of fire. But the thing is, I said to him, come on, it would be so stupid to shoot me in a place like that. But if it happened, okay, fine, I would prefer not to. But it is part of this game. I mean, so many people have lost their lives, beautiful people. But the whole speech, when I ended it, I was surrounded. There was about 40 people rushing forward, and just it ended up with a big group hug. So it was amazing.
Wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful.
And also, you know, the police have been, I've seen in the media that there were pictures of the Danish police pulling, you know, beating up one of the protesters. Absolutely not true. You know, I think the police that behave badly should be totally exposed, you know, should be put up against the wall and confronted with that. But when the police behave well, I think they should be, you know, we should be proud of them and take care of them and so on. And the Danish police that these days were doing a great job, I must say. They were very open for a dialogue. They were very, you know, they came with bulletproof vests the first day. Then on the last day, they were walking around with vests with stickers with the Danish word of love on them. Somebody had put them on. And it was just a beautiful experience, you know. It was almost like the dark, you know, the evil and the good was meeting, the dark and the light, and there was this, I don't know what it, there was, like in the air, it was just like an exorcism, you know, like a boom, like thing that just ended absolutely beautiful.
So, Ole, you're internationally recognized for your work on assassins and assassinations. I know many of our listeners would like to learn more about your research. You have a website, Light, L-I-G-H-T, lightonconspiracies.com. Can you tell us more about where your work is available?
Well, mainly there. And I've written several books. One of them, when it comes to these type of things, is called Coup d'etat in slow motion. It's about the assassination of the Swedish prime minister, but with the whole network surrounding it, because this goes right into the Iran-Contras, the JFK assassination, the illegal arms deals, pedophile, you know, Freemasonry networks. It's so entangled, all of these things. So
coup d'etat in slow motion.
Coup d'etat in slow motion. And if somebody would like to sponsor what I'm doing, I've done this for about 30 years and I'm just an ordinary guy trying to get by and feed my family, you know. So if any type of support, especially financially, is extremely appreciated, you know, sign up for my newsletter.
I so appreciate your coming on, and I would encourage any of our listeners who are in the position to do that to support your research, which in my opinion is very illuminating of some of the darkest recesses of world history in recent times, Ole. I'm very pleased you were able to take time to join us here today.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thank you. Do you know I was almost arrested there?
Well, we don't want to have to use those donations to pay for you to get out of jail. That would be too much, Ole.
No, but it ended in a beautiful way as well, if I can just share the experience. Because it was the first evening. I was just walking down the street, you know, looking around at the hotel, but I was just walking down on the pavement close to this main street, and suddenly this police car pulled over, and I mean, it is so different in Denmark, I think, than from the States, because in Denmark the police are normally very well behaved and so on. Anyway, so this car pulled over and this young police officer came over and said, "Hi, how are you doing?" Very nice and polite and so on. He said, "Would you mind just showing me your ID, you know, your identification?" And I just felt, absolutely not, you know. Absolutely not. This is not okay. I was just walking down the street. So I said, I'm very sorry, but no. And he said, but please, you have to understand that in according to Danish law, it is the law says that if the police ask, you have to identify yourself. I said, I'm sorry, but I will not. The last time I was in Denmark, it was not a police state, and there's absolutely no reason for you to ask me for such a thing without any suspicion. Am I suspected of anything? He said, no, we just want to know your name. So I said, what's your name? If you tell me yours, I'll tell you mine. He said, no, I don't want to do that. I said, then I'm not going to tell you mine either. So the police captain came out of the car, and he came over, very nice man as well, you know. And he said, listen, we're not into games like this. You have to identify yourself or I need to arrest you. I said, okay, fine, but I'm not going to tell you my name. And by the way, do you know who this group is that you are protecting? Because you are actually protecting them from normal people like me. And I'm part of the public that pay your wages to protect us from criminals like them. And he looked a little confused and he said, no, I don't know this group, but we've got people on the inside that can control them. I said, no, you do not, because they're on the outside. They're not let in either. This is a group with total, you know, there's no way anyone can get in there. So I said, really, it's not right. You know, this is not right. And he said, well, I'm not into politics. I said, neither am I. But this is a matter of criminals on a scale that is mind-blowing once you start studying it. So we had, well, it went on like that, and we had about, I think, maybe 2 minutes when we were just looking at each other. You know, very friendly, absolutely no fear, no aggression, no nothing. And I looked in his eyes. This was a gentleman, you know, a kind man, but he had no clue what he was doing. He did not know who he was protecting. And then he said, well, anyway, you need to identify yourself or I must arrest you. I said, I didn't answer. I was just standing there, you know, okay, arrest me if you want, but I'm not going to give you my name. So while we were standing there, because it took quite a long time, there were some other people gathering around. There were some journalists and some other people that came and started filming the whole thing. And so they were getting a bit uncomfortable there. So, but he insisted on arresting me. So I said, but listen, Mr. Kind Police Officer, you know, it is actually, it would be kind of a waste of time. I mean, you can book me, yeah, you take me downtown, you will put me, first you will start asking me a lot of questions who I am. I will say, I will not tell you. Then you will say, if you don't tell me, you will have to stay overnight. I will say, okay, fine, have you got a pillow? And then maybe you'll give me a cup of coffee or... And if you're a nice police officer, maybe you'll drive me back here tomorrow morning or today. It's a total waste of time because I'm not going to tell you. So why don't we do it like this? You promise me you go home tonight and you study the Bilderberg Group. There's lots of information on the internet. You study them so you see who you are protecting. And then I will tell you my name. And he said, okay. So I told him my name. I gave him a totally false address, and the rest was false, but the name was correct. And then I said, so now you're going to go home and check out this group? He said, no. I said, not good for being a police officer, but that's your karma, whatever. And then he at that time, he was getting, you know, there were so many questions from the other people, so he was getting a bit stressed. So, while he was controlling my name, I you know, I just walked off and let him be there with the rest. I think he was there for half an hour trying to answer questions from the rest of the people. But it was a very interesting confrontation, because I think with so many of these things, it's a mindset. You know, if you buy into the fear mode, if you get aggressive or you become afraid or you try to fight back or, you know, like that, you're lost. You're in their ball games. But if you stand totally fearless with no aggression and just absolutely refuse whatever they say, it just diffuses. Somehow it just diffuses. So I thought it was a beautiful experience.
Nicely done, my friend. And when they provide you with a pillow, they could also provide coffee and a Danish.
There you go. I had expected that. Or I could buy him one and we could have a nice chat, you know. I would be happy with that.
Ole, I'm delighted you're here. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Ole Damgaard, for being here. Check out his website, lightonconspiracies.com. Follow it up. His work is extraordinary. We'll be right back.